So if you would, go ahead and start off by turning in your Bibles to the book of Jonah, chapter 1. That's where we're going to be starting, if you couldn't tell by the slide. Jonah and the Gourd. Well, that's kind of a strange title, isn't it? Jonah and the Gourd. What is it normally? What do we normally think of Jonah as being related to? Right. Shouldn't that say Jonah and the whale? Well, I actually think that the gourd might be an even more important thing, or more important lesson to be had than the whale. Now, the whale definitely has important significance, no doubt, but the gourd in itself provides a very important lesson for us that I want us to be able to look at this morning. And we're going to actually attempt to make it through the whole book. It's actually only four chapters, and the four chapters are pretty short. So we're going to have the goal of getting through the whole book, and I think we'll be able to do that pretty easily. So to start us off with, we need to become familiar with the city of Nineveh, okay? So Nineveh was located in Mesopotamia. I believe it would have been to the east of the Tigris River. And you might think of this as being in modern Iraq. Okay? So Nineveh is located in Mesopotamia in modern Iraq. It's going to be the third capital of Assyria. So Assyria was a kingdom that lasted for a really long time. So around 2400 BC, it came into an existence and lasted until its overthrow in about 612 BC. So we're talking about a kingdom that was around for a long time. And it was around for so long that it actually saw three different capitals within its time period. I believe that Nineveh would have been the last city to actually be considered the capital. Now, if we go to the Bible, we go to Genesis chapter 10, we can actually learn about where Nineveh came from. Okay, it says, Cush begot Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, Calnech, and the land of Shinar. From that land, he went to Assyria and built Nineveh. All right, so before this verse, okay, we're given a pretty quick rundown on how the lineage came out. And so it went Noah. So we had the flood. Noah gets off of the ark. And now he has Ham as his son. Ham has Cush. Cush is Nimrod. Nimrod is going to be the one that establishes Nineveh. Actually, I believe that Nimrod is the one that establishes the Assyrian Empire itself. Well, it wasn't an empire then, right? It was in its early days. But he's going to be the one that establishes Assyria, establishes the city of Nineveh. Okay, so pretty close family to Noah, actually. Not very far down the line. What's interesting about, if you look at the history of Nineveh, where the name came from, where they believe the city came from, and just the Assyrian empire to begin with, Nineveh means abode of Ninus. And Ninus, well, before we go to that, I'll talk about Ninus here in a second. Nin was the Assyrian version of Hercules. Okay, so Ninus is going to be the Greek. Ninus is going to be a Greek mythological king. And Nin is going to be the Assyrian version of Hercules, which is actually really interesting whenever you consider. It says here in Genesis chapter 10 that Nimrod was a mighty one on the earth. And so it definitely looks and seems like the Assyrian mythology about Nin, who was basically the founder of Nineveh. Nin was like the Greek Hercules. They obviously got that story of this mighty man like Hercules from Genesis chapter 10. So that Assyrian mythology, the Greek mythology, they would have used Genesis chapter 10 as a source for those things. They would have looked back and known, oh yeah, the man that founded Nineveh, the man that founded the Assyrian Empire, he was a mighty man. And then from there, they created their own myths. But Genesis chapter 10 is where the truth of it would have been. And like I said, King Ninus in the Greek mythology was known to be the founder. So it's interesting to see how the Greeks and the Assyrians, how they took their mythology from truth, but they made it their own thing. And that's actually an Assyrian depiction of the god Nin. Any question, or lowercase g. Any questions or comments about that little rundown on Nineveh? Okay. Oh, and really important to know this. This is super important. In 720 BC, Assyria conquered Israel. Okay, that's kind of going to be an important factor for the book of Jonah. All right, so if we're looking at where Nineveh is, okay, so obviously we see Jerusalem off to the way off to the east, Nineveh way, you know, sorry, west, Nineveh way off to the east, quite a distance there. And then we'll learn why Joppa and why there's this line that shows his journey, why that goes the opposite direction. Okay, so we go to chapter 1. It says, "Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai." We'll say Amittai. "The son of Amittai, saying, Arise, go to Nineveh, the great city, and cry out against it, for their wickedness has come up before me. But Jonah arose to flee to Tarshish, from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord." All right. So let's ask the first question. Why does Jonah intend to go to Tarshish? Why does he do that? I don't want to go to Nineveh. Why doesn't he want to go to Nineveh? Exactly. Yeah. Jonah wants something very different for the Ninevites than what God wants for the Ninevites. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But yeah, he doesn't want to go to the Ninevites. And actually, if we go to Nahum chapter 3, we get a little picture of what Nineveh looks like. It says, "Woe to the bloody city. It is all full of lies and robbery. Its victim never departs. The noise of a whip and the noise of rattling wheels, of galloping horses, of clattering chariots. Horsemen charged, bright sword and glittering spear. There is a multitude of slain, a great number of bodies, countless corpses. They stumble over the corpses. Because of the multitude of the harlotries of the seductive harlot, mistress of sorceries, who sells nations through her harlotries and families through her sorceries." Bad place. Bad place. And if you read some of the classical histories, okay, so some of the histories outside of the Bible about the conqueror, whenever the Ninevites, when Assyria, they would go out and conquer others, they did some really, really horrible things. There were actually cities and groups of people that would kill themselves before the Ninevites got to them, just so that they wouldn't undergo the torture that the Ninevites would put them through upon conquering them. Because whenever the Ninevites would conquer somebody, they would literally skin them alive and put their skins on walls of the city. Sorry, that's probably too much. So the Ninevites were some bad folks, okay? So we can understand why Jonah is like, yeah, I'm not going there. I'm not going to Nineveh. That place doesn't even need saved. Okay? They don't need to be saved. And the other thing to know, too, is what's going to be the big difference between Israel and Nineveh. The Ninevites aren't. They're Gentiles, right? They're not Jews. Okay, so they're going to be Gentiles, and so Jonah doesn't want to go to them. Now, let's continue reading. The storm at sea, verse 4. "But the Lord sent out a great wind on the sea." Okay, so he's on the ship going to Tarshish. I do want to point this out. This doesn't show it, And we don't actually know where Tarshish is, but we think that it's around Spain. So note that whenever he went to this place, he was literally going to what he thought to be like the edge of the world. For him, to go to this place, which is near Spain, you could not go any further the opposite direction. So he went to what he thought to be the other side of the world. He really, really didn't want to go to Nineveh. Okay, let's continue. But the Lord sent out a great wind on the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea, so that the ship was about to be broken up. Then the mariners were afraid, and every man cried out to his God, and threw the cargo that was in the ship into the sea to lighten the load. But Jonah had gone down into the lowest part of the ship and had lain down and was fast asleep. What kind of storm is this, guys? What kind of storm is this, and what evidence do you have of that? I'm just trying to get you to talk a little bit. This is an easy question. Huh? Oh, yeah. It's bad. It's so bad that let me ask you this. Under what circumstance would you throw all of your goods and luggage and things you're going to sell out the window or off the truck, right? You wouldn't go to throwing your cargo off of the ship unless you felt that your life was in danger, right? So the fact that they are throwing stuff off the ship tells us that they're in trouble. Like, serious peril. And what is Jonah doing? Oh, he's sleeping. And I can't wrap my mind around that. I'm like, well, why is he sleeping? You know, what does this tell us about Jonah? I don't know. So the captain came to him and said to him, "What do you mean, sleeper? Arise, call on your God. Perhaps your God will consider us so that we may not perish." And they said to one another, "Come, let us cast lots, that we may know for whose cause this trouble has come upon us." So they're just trying to, they obviously think this is a superstitious thing, right? They're like, this is not a normal storm. They said, they recognize this is not a normal storm. Maybe it wasn't the right season for it. And they recognize someone on this boat did something really wrong. Because this is not normal. And we need to figure out who it is. Maybe it's this inconspicuous man sleeping during it all, right? So come, let us cast lots that we may know for whose cause this trouble has come upon us. So they cast lots, and the lot fell on Jonah. When they said to him, "Please tell us, for whose cause is this trouble upon us? What is your occupation? Where do you come from? What is your country? And of what people are you?" Okay. So really quick, what does that tell us? What do we know about these people probably? Are these Jews or are these Gentiles? I'm going to assume they're Gentiles. I'm going to assume they're probably Gentiles because they don't know God, right? And they're saying pray to any God that you can to figure this thing out. Okay, so he said to them, "I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." Then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to him, "Why have you done this?" For the men knew that he fled from the presence of the Lord because he had told them. Okay, so there's a section here that's not told to us. Okay, he doesn't lay it all out how he told it to them. But he said, I'm a Hebrew. And I worship God. Here's who he is, and here's what I've done. And these godless people, these heathen, are like, "Why have you done this?" Like, even they know how bad Jonah has messed up. "Why have you done this and brought it with you?" Right? You can imagine how upset they probably are. And so this puts them in a bit of a pickle. And he said to them, Jonah says to them, "Pick me up and throw me into the sea, then the sea will become calm for you." for I know this great tempest is because of me. Nevertheless, the men rowed hard to return to land, but they could not, for the sea continued to grow more tempestuous against them. So did they want to do what Jonah asked them to do? Did they want to throw them off board? Which says a lot about the people that were in charge of the boat. I mean, they're about to die. And throwing this guy off of the side of the boat, fix it all maybe. But they don't want to do that. And so, partly probably because they don't want to be responsible for killing a prophet of God after seeing what he's been, what he's done, right? So they keep on rowing. I know we're going to figure out another way around this. We're not throwing you off. If we kill a prophet of God, how much worse is that going to be for us? And so therefore they cried out to the Lord and said, "We pray, O Lord, please do not let us perish for this man's life. And do not charge us with the innocent blood, for you, O Lord, have done it pleased you." Sorry. "O Lord, have done as it pleased you." So they picked up Jonah and threw him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly and offered a sacrifice to the Lord and took vows. So obviously they became believers right then, right? This is a pretty miraculous situation that they find themselves in. All right, let's pause there for a moment. Let's look at the character of Jonah a little bit. What are you guys getting from Jonah? What do you think about his character so far and who he is? And what are you thinking about him based off of what we're reading here? About what happened in the ship?
Well, he's running from God, but he still boasts about him, passes the word on him. You know. He's not ashamed of being a...
He doesn't want to do what God has told him to do. But at the same time, he still respects God. He still respects his position as a prophet of God. And he still proclaims God. You know, I think that Noah is definitely a very real person. You know, because I think that we might be the same way in a lot of ways, where we respect God and we love God and we proclaim God, though sometimes we may run from what we know he wants us to do. That's something that we do, right? So Noah is showing some characteristic here. It's very like it to what we do. What else? Any other characteristics you find interesting about Noah?
Jonah.
Thank you. not Noah.
They said he was a Hebrew, so I don't know. But makes you think he's maybe wasn't.
He definitely was. Yeah.
So
yeah.
You know, you can't throw that away. That was the reason.
Right.
There.
Yep.
He wasn't willing to sacrifice over. Cowardice.
Yeah. You got a hand to him. I mean, he said, "Take me off the boat in the middle of the sea," right? He knows, and I would think that he would know that probably means his peril. Or he trusts that God will save him, I don't know which. But he was willing to sacrifice himself for the good of the others.
He's no coward. He was just disobedient.
He was what? Yes. Yeah. Right. He was honest. He wasn't a coward.
He wasn't even
just in disobedience.
Dishonest about his intentions with the Ninevites. He's like, "Listen, I'll tell these randos who are willing to save my life on this boat about how great you are, God. That's cool. But those Ninevites, I'm not going to touch that one." Hmm. He wasn't dishonest about that.
He has very strong convictions, doesn't he? I think that we see he has very strong convictions. He has very strong convictions about God. He has very strong convictions about the Ninevites. And would literally put himself in peril before going and preaching to them. But he's always honest in this whole situation. It's a good point. The fact that he's sleeping, what do we take away from that? I'm curious about what your thoughts are on why he's on him sleeping. Do you think there's anything to that, or do you think that that's just he was really tired? What do you guys think?
Terrible.
Yeah.
I'm telling you right now, I've been in
stomach
lately. I thought I was gone.
Yeah.
And, but he was at ease.
He was at ease.
I think.
Yeah. Anything else? Anybody else have an opinion on the sleeping?
I have something, but I want to get a verse first.
While you're doing that, I saw Greg maybe start. Did you have a thought, Greg?
Well, he must have been at ease with his decision. Sleep.
Yeah.
But I like the way he accepted responsibility when they called it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Really commendable. Did you find it?
Yes. It just really calls to mind Matthew 8:23.
Okay.
I'll just read it. 23:24. And when he got into the boat, his disciples followed him, and Jesus. And behold, there arose a great storm over the sea, so the boat was being swamped by the waves. But he was asleep.
Really?
It instantly took me to that verse. Like, obviously, it's different. Jesus knew. Like,
yeah.
Jesus was like, I'll take care of it. Obviously, Jonah wasn't just going to take care of it. He didn't right. have that power. But he knew what was happening.
So I think that's actually, I'm glad that you said that. I didn't think of that. I think that's actually a really good segue into the next part of this conversation. So let's go to verse 17. It says, now the Lord had prepared a great fish to swallow Jonah. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. Okay. Now, let's ask ourselves, what parallels exist between Christ and Jonah? And I think that you definitely got to start off on the right path there, because I actually didn't even consider that parallel. We see that Jesus himself parallels himself with what occurred here in the first chapter of Jonah. It says, and then, Matthew 12, verse 38, says, then some of the scribes and Pharisees answered, saying, Teacher, we want to see a sign from you. But he answered and said to them, an evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign will be given except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will rise up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it, because they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and indeed, a greater than Jonah is here. Okay, so that last part we can unpack a little bit later on whenever we get to chapter 3. But if we look at the first part of chapter 12, what are the parallels that exist between Christ and Jonah?
It's okay to state the obvious. What does Jesus say the parallel is?
Was he buried in the earth? Jesus was buried in the earth 3 days and three nights.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, so just as Jonah being swallowed by a whale and going to the depths of the ocean, I mean, that's about as deep in the earth as I think a person can probably physically actually get.
And so, but it's saying that just as, so Jesus is saying just as Jonah underwent that, I'm going to undergo that as well. I'm going to go deep into the earth, so to speak, to a place that no man has gone. In return from that.
There might be a little bit of faith thing going on too. There's no way you're not going to sleep if you don't have absolute faith in God.
Absolutely. So just as
he wasn't afraid of death, he trusted God to do what he was going to do.
Absolutely. So just as Jesus was able to sleep because he knew things were fine, it seems that Jonah himself also had that kind of faith. Maybe he knew that things were fine. Which would have been so puzzling to the other men on the boat, right? Because, I mean, Scripture talks about us having a peace that is beyond understanding, right? We've talked about that, a peace that's beyond understanding. And it would seem that that Jonah had that peace beyond understanding. Because the other people said, they're like, they called him sleeper because they don't understand why he's able to sleep during such a storm, right?
Don't we all wish we had that?
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, I'm kidding on myself.
Yeah.
I wish I had the peace that I could just lay down and shut up and go to sleep.
Right.
It'd be kind of hard for me to do.
Yeah, no, I mean, the whole thing is a really...
I mean, he trusted God. That's what we got to do in this day and life. We got to trust him. It's just like I had a guy tell me the other day, I don't know what's going to happen to this country. I said, God's in charge. Let him take care of it.
That's right.
He will. And I believe that. I believe he will. It may not be the way we want it, but you've got to have that peace.
I think that the story of what happened with Jonah in this ship, I'm not saying it's allegory as if it's not true, because it is true, but I'll use the word anyways. I feel like it's a really good allegory for what we go through in our lives, right? So what we encounter in the long run of our lives is very much related to exactly what he went through in that short period of time. Great points.